From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. The gloves were off last night in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
You talked about Ronald Reagan being a transformative political leader. I did not mention his name.
Your husband did.
Well, I'm here. He's
okay,
not.
Okay, well,
and
I can't tell who I'm running against sometimes.
Well.
Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards got up close and personal last night in a Democratic debate sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus Institute and CNN. With just 4 days left until the South Carolina Democratic primary, the economy, health care, and racial politics dominated the debate. But who made the biggest impression? And is the contest any closer after last night? Joining us to offer some morning after analysis is Ron Walters, a political science professor at the University of Maryland, and Robert Smith. He is a political science professor at San Francisco State University. Ron, Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
A lot to talk about, so let's get right to it. Last night was probably the most exciting debate the Democrats have had so far, certainly the most exciting that I have seen. But today, some people are criticizing the time-draining personal attacks between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama that struck a nasty tone during the two-hour telecast. Ron, what do you make of the squabbling? John Edwards, for example, said it did no good, but it did show us something about those two candidates, didn't it?
It did, but I think that this was more than squabbling. We have, I think, to connect this debate to the last debate. And in the last debate, Barack Obama was widely viewed by many people as having come off weak. This debate is set in the context of an election, in case anybody noticed. And he's got to appear at least that he's in command. He's in command in terms of the public opinion polling, and he can't be ahead in the public opinion polling and having a weak performance in a presidential debate. So these things are linked together. And I think given that, he had to continue to prove his electability by the credibility of his ideas. And so he had to defend those ideas in that arena.
Everybody did that, Robert, in fact, defended themselves. It felt like a prize fight at times, though. Did it go too far in your view?
No, I don't think it went too far. Senator Obama had signaled earlier in the day that he had planned to take on Mrs. Clinton and her husband, and he attempted to do that. I think, however, that he came out somewhat on the defensive in terms of his health care plan, the talk about Reagan, even his votes in the Illinois Senate. So I don't think he particularly gained as a consequence of the little squabble last night.
Well, the Bill Clinton issue certainly was a lightning rod for Obama and for Mrs. Clinton as well. Do you think, Ron, that Bill Clinton has gone too far in his support of his wife's candidacy?
Well, yes, and not only do I think that, you've got moguls inside of the Democratic Party like Ron Manuel and some of the others asking him. As a matter of fact, there was a testy exchange between Clinton and Ron Manuel about this very thing, that some of the leaders of the party don't want these arguments to get so out of hand that they dampen down the enthusiasm of people to turn out in the fall. I mean, you go back to 1984, Reverend Jackson's run, people were wildly enthusiastic, so much so that 2 million more people turned out that fall. They want the same thing because the stakes are enormous. They want to have a veto-proof Senate. They want to increase their lead in the House, and obviously they want the White House. So they want people to turn out.
The three candidates eventually calmed down in the second half of the debate when it seemed they were more reflective and tried to paint distinct pictures of themselves and show how they are different. Did either of you, Ron and Robert, get the sense that we saw, perhaps for the very first time, some real differences between these three candidates?
Well, on the health care plan, there is a minor kind of almost technical difference. But really, I think on most of the issues, the three candidates are in agreement. And that is why I think you really have to draw kind of personality style distinctions, because on the war, on the economy, there's broad agreement. So I didn't see any policy differences except for the distinction about whether or not Senator Obama's health care plan covers everybody.
Did you see it the same way, Ron?
Yeah, pretty much the same way. I'd agree with Bob. There was, I think at the heart of this, though, something that really struck me that Barack Obama said. And it had to do with how do you campaign against the presumptive, the guy who's beginning to emerge on the Republican side, and that's John McCain. Hillary talked about the fact that she could hit the ground running day one, in effect, that she would be a good commander-in-chief. Barack said, no, that's not how I think to beat this guy. He wants to be a commander-in-chief of a failing war. We need somebody to make the tremendous difference here. In other words, a commander of peace, if you will. I think that's the same mistake the Democrats made with Kerry, trying to compete with the president, a sitting president of the United States, by offering up somebody who could pursue the war better. I think that there's at least some Democrats have learned that you've got to go a different way. And this was one of the sharpest differences to me in this debate.
Let's talk about this for a moment. I want to play a clip from John Edwards. In several previous debates, he tended to side with Obama to double-team Clinton. But let's listen to this exchange between him and Obama last night.
The question is, why would you over 100 times vote present?
John,
I mean, every one of us, you've criticized Hillary, you've criticized me for our votes. We cast hundreds and hundreds of votes. What you're criticizing her for, by the way, you've done to us, which is you pick this vote and that vote out of the hundreds that we've cast.
So talk about that for a moment, if you can, Ron. Was Edwards siding with Clinton more this time around? And if so, what's behind that strategy?
I think that John Edwards has had one strategy, and that's to try to distinguish himself against both of these candidates. He tried it, first of all, by appearing to side with Barack Obama. The objective there was to try to muscle Hillary Clinton to the side. That really hasn't worked. And so now he finds himself having to confront Barack Obama to try to make him stand out. Now, looking at this debate last night, I think he did a tremendous job. As a matter of fact, some people say that he won it. So he's got to change strategy, and I think we're beginning to see that with this debate.
Robert, there were issues that were discussed last night. Health care was certainly big. So was the economy. And as a matter of fact, just this morning, the Federal Reserve slashed a key interest rate by 0.75 percentage point. Who, in your view, seemed to score the most points with their economic proposals during the debate?
I would think Mrs. Clinton had the more detailed discussion of that. She's the first of the three to actually advance an economic program. And she was much more, I thought she was much more sharper in her statement of her ideas. And Senator Obama and Senator Edwards were, in a sense, kind of playing catch up. But again, I think there's fundamental agreement on the need for a package, economic stimulus package, to be passed fairly soon. But I thought she was a little bit better on that.
You share that view, Ron?
I think that at the time that they all put out their plans, we're talking about a difference here of $45 billion, John Edwards, up to $75 billion for Hillary Clinton. At the time they put them all out, almost simultaneously, she didn't have a rebate aspect of it. Barack Obama did. So she went back and released another version of her economic stimulus plan, which had a rebate package. Part of that, of course, was a result that the Senate Joint Economic Committee had held hearings, and the rebate package was talked about there, and this was after the last debate.
The candidates keep saying that they want to keep race out of the presidential race, but all week we have seen how much Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, even John Edwards have campaigned specifically for the black vote, which in the state of South Carolina makes up about 50% of the voting bloc. Here's my question, Robert, to you first. What about the remaining 50%? Are they mostly white, and are they being left out of the equation?
Well, they are mostly white, and I think Obama has a paradox of a black man trying to run a deracialized campaign. He clearly needs to win South Carolina, and he needs to win it with a good share of the black vote. But I think he also needs to pick up a good share of the white vote. Otherwise, I think the Clintons, if he wins, will attempt to paint his victory as they will attempt to diminish his victory if he wins largely on the basis of black support. And so I think that was a very, very delicate game he's trying to play, particularly in South Carolina. He wants to appeal to the black vote, but he wants to do it in such a way as to not appear, if I can say it this way, appear black or appear to be appealing to black interests per se. I think it's a very difficult project that he's involved in.
We have about 1 minute left for this with you, Ron Walters, and it's Robert mentioned that he felt that Barack Obama must win South Carolina, but John Edwards, who was born in that state and is the only Southerner in the Democratic race and who has not fared particularly well so far, he has to win or at least have a very good showing, doesn't he? And how far did last night's debate go toward that? About 50
seconds.
Well,
I think John Edwards is out of this, quite frankly speaking, because he doesn't appear. If you look at the polling in the other Super Tuesday states, you don't really see a John Edwards campaign. And so he's hanging on, hoping that he's going to be able to pick up someplace. But he needed to score well in the debate last night. He did. But the politics of the matter, I don't think, is going to help him very much. I was surprised that this debate last night didn't lean more heavily on issues related to the African-American experience, given the fact that it was sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus. But I think one of the reasons that you didn't hear that was precisely what Bob said. Here is this very delicate balance that they have to walk. And so this debate, as far as Barack Obama is concerned, and perhaps some of the others, could not be too, I think, unbalanced on the side of the black community.
We have to stop right there. Robert, Ron, thank you both very much. Ron Walters is a political science professor at the University of Maryland. He spoke with us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Robert Smith is a political science professor at San Francisco State University. He joined us from UC Berkeley School of Journalism Studios. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. It's time now for our Africa update. In Congo, a deal to end post-election violence awaits signing. Meanwhile, Kofi Annan tells feuding Kenyans they must begin talks to end the fighting after troubled elections. For more now, we've got Amira Woods. She is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hi, Amira.
Hi, Tony. It's great to be with you.
Thank you very much. Congo's government and rebel groups have reached a deal to end fighting in the east. At least 400,000 people have fled their homes over the last year as a result of the violent dispute over the presidential election, the first in more than four decades in the country. Now, we're hearing today that last-minute disagreements over the peace deal between Congo's government, Tutsi rebels, and the Mai Mai military may put off the signing which was scheduled for today. Why is it so hard to get a deal like this to hold?
Well, it comes down to one thing. It's richness of the soil. It's almost a curse there in the Congo. We have to remember it's a long tradition of resource-rich regions having actual conflicts going on for both economic and political control of those areas. And the Congo, like many other places, is really suffering from its richness. It's gold, it's diamonds, it's rubber, it's also coltan, without which you couldn't have cell phones or computers. So it is the richness of the land that ends up being, in many cases, the curse.
So is that what the Mai Mai are holding out for? Is that what they are objecting to in this very complicated agreement?
Well, let's remember, you know, the Congo is a difficult place. The elections before the last happened back in 1960s. It's when Patrice Lumumba was actually elected president of the Congo. From that time, when Lumumba was actually assassinated, right, and Mobutu put in place to control those very richness on the soil and below the soil, from that time until this past election just a year ago now, you know, you didn't have an electoral process take place in the country. So issues around popular voice, issues around vote, issues around control of both wealth and political power, those issues are very much at play. And it is extraordinary that the deal has been worked out under the stewardship of the African Union and other negotiators. It is a historic step forward, but it is not yet a done deal.
All right, let's move on to Kenya. Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, is in Nairobi attempting to broker a deal that would end the violence disputed there. The Associated Press is reporting that he is now telling the feuding parties that they must enter dialogue. But violence again erupted just today with police firing tear gas on supporters of the disputed president. The opposition party claims the election weeks ago was rigged, and more than a quarter million Kenyans have been displaced by the post-election violence, more than 650 people killed. So what is Kofi Annan up against as he tries to bring these parties together?
Kofi Annan is up against people who are saying no. 8 years into this new century, we cannot have a stolen election. And you have real tensions at play in Kenya with hopes for a democratic process and it's extremely dashed. And so what's at play is an enormous public discontent and resentment and tension on both ends. And so what is needed is a steady hand. And Kofi Annan, with all of the expertise, having been UN Secretary General. We also have Graca Machel, the wife of Nelson Mandela, bringing also the political gravitas of Mandela to bear, to bring all sides to the table, to keep all sides at the table, to make sure that a negotiated resolution can take place as the economy spirals out of control and the political violence remains really unabated.
Some analysts are calling the post-election violence a generational revolution, meaning Kenya's younger generation fighting the older establishment for power. Is that an oversimplistic description of what's occurring there?
Well, it's fascinating to watch what's happening. It's not only Kenya, but in many places around the world where people are saying no to electoral processes being manipulated, you know? So it's Pakistan, it's Georgia, you know, it's clearly an issue even here in the U.S. So Tony, we have to keep a watch at this. It is younger people who are very much marginalized from a political process that hasn't brought forth the type of economic reward or the type of political space that many would have anticipated. And so you have the frustrations of the young, but now that's being coupled with more of a middle class and an urban more human rights organizations that are and actors and leaders that are saying no to this process. And so it is not only the discontent of the young that is being coupled with the discontent of human rights activists and civil society leaders from across the spectrum saying no to manipulation of both an electoral process and also a judicial process that's changing judges right before the election and those types of improprieties that really should not be accepted.
Moving on, Nigeria, the next stop where three international tobacco firms are being sued. Nigeria says tobacco manufacturers are targeting their youth and putting a strain on the healthcare system. British American Tobacco, Philip Morris, and International Tobacco Limited deny the claims and say they do not target children. What about this action? What's behind it, and is there any hope for a successful resolution to it?
Oh, Tony, this one is exciting because for so long, multinational corporations have had their way in the developing world, in the world at large. Corporations have gone really running amok around the world. And the tobacco companies are top of the list. Yes, oil companies as well. But the tobacco companies have targeted minors in many instances, particularly in the developing world, and have gone unchecked. And so for the first time, the Nigerian government has said, we will stand up against these tobacco companies. It is, you know, the first time for the developing world to say no. We demand a different way that will protect the health and the needs of our people, the young people in particular of our countries. And so it is extraordinary that this legislative route has happened, that the, you know, using the court system to hold these tobacco companies accountable. And you see, as pressure mounts on particularly the tobacco companies here in the U.S., where, you know, there are certain regulations against them advertising to minors, yet they'll find ways to still advertise and sponsor sporting events and the rest. But in Africa, you know, they have gone unabated, actually giving out in many instances samples to young people on street corners. So it is extraordinary that the Nigerian government has taken the stance. And I think we have to watch and hope that there will be many others to follow.
Final subject on today's Africa Update, Zimbabwe. Runaway inflation there has made it nearly impossible for people to buy goods, a critical shortage of cash in the country. And so what do? They print more money. And now a $10 million, $10 million banknote in the to help the Zimbabwean economy. We've got less than 2 minutes, Amira. What is this really going to do?
Not a whole lot, let's just say. You know, so that $10 million sounds big, but it comes up to about $4 here in the U.S. And, you know, to put this in context, a medical doctor, you know, middle-class medical doctor right now is reportedly earning an income for a month of about $18. So you see that this question of the economy really spiraling out of control in Zimbabwe is very much still in play, regardless of this new bill being issued. And this is going to continue to be a problem, especially as Zimbabwe heads towards elections this year. So both the economic instability and crisis, as exhibited by the spiraling inflation, and now the political crisis that's going to continue as you move towards an electoral process. I think we got to keep our eyes on Zimbabwe for quite some time to come.
Amira, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Tony.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She was at our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Mountain guerrilla killings in Central Africa have reached an all-time high. Current fighting among the Congolese military and rebels has caused park rangers and other locals to flee the area, ultimately leaving one of the world's most endangered animals seemingly unprotected. These killings reach deep into the economy, the local community, and the environment. For more, we are joined now by Craig Sholley. He is a senior director at the African Wildlife Foundation and former director of Rwanda's Mountain Gorilla Project. Craig, nice to have you on the show.
Very nice to be here, Tony. Thank you.
Let's start with this. Can you describe a mountain gorilla for us? I'm sure most people have seen pictures and/or specials on television, but tell us about some of their features and traits. For example, are they killers?
No, not at all. Actually, mountain gorillas are known as gentle giants, and they are the world's largest great ape. A big male, a silverback, can weigh as much as 425 pounds. And so you're talking about an immensely powerful creature, but one that lives in a family unit. He basically directs activity in the unit and takes care of a group of females and his progeny. So it's a very, very special relationship that a silverback, a big male, has with the members of his family.
As we've noted, the mountain gorilla is a highly endangered species. How did it come to this?
Well, mountain gorilla numbers were probably never, ever very high. They probably ranked in the tens of thousands at one point. The numbers now are probably about 700 in the world, and they range in two populations on the border of Uganda, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So we're talking about probably the world's most endangered great ape.
Can you tell us why these gorillas are being killed and who's killing them?
Well, it ranks as a mystery at this particular point. We have been very, very successful in conserving mountain gorilla populations over the last 15 to 20 years. Obviously, there's a tourism economy that is based on gorilla trekking, and in particular in Uganda and Rwanda, populations are very, very stable, and they're very, very well protected. People come from all over the world to visit mountain gorillas, to go out and spend a wonderful hour in the company of a mountain gorilla family. However, across the border in DRC, of course, for the last 15 years, there has been political instability, an awful lot of violence, many, many people killed. Estimates at this particular point range from 2.5 million to 3 million throughout the countryside in eastern DRC. So it's a phenomenally volatile situation, and trying to conserve a very, very endangered great ape in this situation is very challenging.
I was struck by something that you just said, that people, tourists, come there to spend time with these gorilla families. Describe more specifically what you meant in terms of what kind of contact average, you know, tourists might have. Are we talking about looking through binoculars from a car at some distance? How close up do we get to them?
Well, I think it's probably one of the most special wildlife viewing experiences in the world. This is a situation wherein people have the ability to go out into the home of the mountain gorilla, trek on forested trails. And ultimately, you're going to be very, very close to a family of gorillas, probably within 15 to 20 feet
really?
Of the entire family. And you've got the ability to sit from that distance and observe natural behavior.
You know, there have been stories written about park rangers and others who have very strong personal connections to these animals. I know that some of them have named them. How does that come about?
Well, the park rangers, in my opinion, are the real heroes of mountain gorilla conservation. They're the guys who are out on a day-to-day basis doing the work of conservation. And in the case of DRC, they're risking their lives. We probably have lost 120 to 150 guards over the last 15 years in the Congo. And I think it indicates the kind of courage that these guys have, putting their life on the line, protecting animals that they've worked with on a day-to-day basis for, in some cases, decades.
Are there other animals that are also endangered in that area, especially as a result of the fighting, in addition to the gorilla?
You've got an awful lot of wildlife in this particular area. The gorillas, of course, live in a montane, a forested habitat. Immediately adjacent to this lovely forested park in Congo is a fantastic savanna situation, Virunga National Park. And there you've got elephants, you've got big carnivores, you've got hippopotamus, you've got a wide variety of wildlife that lives in the lower elevations. In the forested areas, you do have elephants. You've got a very, very unique species of monkey, the golden monkey. A subspecies of blue monkey. And so the mountain gorilla shares its habitat with a variety of other species. And the very cool thing about mountain gorillas is that they are the flagship species that, if protected, can protect the rest of the environment and the other creatures that it shares its home with.
You call the park rangers heroes, and you talked about their valiant efforts on behalf of trying to, at least, protect these gorillas. What's being done overall to protect them? What about those efforts?
Well, I think the African Wildlife Foundation, in conjunction with its partner, the International Gorilla Conservation Program, is there as a support to ICCN and Uganda Wildlife Authority and ORTPN, the Rwandan National Park System. And for the last 30 years, as a matter of fact, we've been there providing infrastructure support. In some cases, we've been providing salaries. We've helped develop protocol that allows the park rangers to work in a situation that in most cases is safe and secure across the border in DRC. It's not at this particular point, but we're there doing the best we can in order to support the efforts of these courageous men.
Does that mean that there is international support for this effort?
Absolutely. The International Gorilla Conservation Program is actually a consortium of conservation NGOs made up of the African Wildlife Foundation, Worldwide Fund for Nature, and Fauna Flora International out of England. And I think this is a very, very cool relationship that has existed between conservation NGOs for the last 30 years, probably the longest of its kind. And together, the three organizations basically have supported the International Gorilla Conservation Program, which works in the three countries that I've been talking about.
What do you believe is going to happen to them ultimately?
Well, mountain gorillas are a very, very special creature. They're in my opinion, one of our closest relatives, and I think it's incumbent upon the world to do as much as we can to protect them. We work directly with an awful lot of local communities whose livelihoods are improved as a result of the money brought in from gorilla trekking. I hope that the situation in DRC will stabilize to the point wherein the Congolese can also benefit and that gorillas can survive well into the future.
Craig, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Pleasure to be here.
Craig Shally is a senior director at the African Wildlife Foundation and former director of Rwanda's Mountain Gorilla Project. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We know Jackie Robinson as Major League Baseball's first black player, a Hall of Famer who stood as a symbol of integration and civil rights. But after retirement, Robinson set out to make his pen as mighty as his bat ever was. Robinson wrote letters and corresponded with many of the greatest players in the civil rights arena. Here's a bit of a letter to Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., May 13, 1967.
Dear Martin, in my book, you've always been the greatest civil rights mastermind and leader which the movement has ever had. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel you are utterly on the wrong track in your stand on Vietnam. I'm confused because I respect you deeply, but I also love this imperfect country. I respectfully ask you to answer this open letter and give me your own point of view, with the deepest regard and the deepest confusion.
The Civil Rights Letters of Jackie Robinson are compiled in a new book called First Class Citizenship. It's edited by Michael Long.
I discovered that Jackie Robinson had written lots of letters to lots of leaders, everybody from Ike Eisenhower to Malcolm X, from John Kennedy to Martin Luther King.
We know that he was a ferocious competitor, keeping his head in the game and ignoring the racial indignities that were spewed his way while he was integrating Major League Baseball. In 1960, though, we find a retired Jackie Robinson working as a columnist for the New York Post, and it was during an election year. Talk, if you will, about two things. One, this informal civil rights leader and how that insinuated his politics.
Because he was so committed to establishing first-class citizenship for what he would call my people. And that was his number one commitment. That was his major passion after baseball. And he would frequently say, you know, the baseball years were good. My real passion is in civil rights. And it's for advancing my people, to helping them get into the economic mainstream, helping voting rights to come along. So this was his real major passion after baseball.
Now, that's one of the things. Let me stop you there to say that's one of the things that makes the letters between Jackie Robinson and Richard Nixon at the time so compelling reading. I'd like to direct your attention to one letter in particular in the book.
My dear Mr. Nixon, Kennedy has sent to others, as he did to me, your record prior to 1950. I, too, need answers to negative questions people constantly put at me. Believe me, it is most difficult to answer people who seem to have documentary evidence of what you said or did. When you withhold positive things, an image isn't easy to erase. But it can be done if you display a warmth or as much sincerity as you can regarding the Negro status. Many of my friends have expressed an interest, but the great majority say, I don't feel I can go along at the present time. Thanks again. Sincerely yours, Jackie Robinson.
Now, he supported Richard Nixon and got a great deal of flack for that, didn't he?
Yes, he did. By the way, Rachel Robinson was no big fan of Richard Nixon either. Nevertheless, Jackie Robinson was very attracted to Richard Nixon. He believed that Nixon made many pro-civil rights statements, and indeed Nixon did. In the early 1950s, he would say things like, every act of discrimination in the United States is like handing the communists a gun. And Robinson ate that up. He loved that because very few politicians were talking like that. And so he was a big fan of Nixon in 1960. And yes, indeed, he took a lot of flack for it.
Jackie Robinson, through the letters, indicates that his positions changed. Also, to some degree, with Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Now, here's a letter that was written from Robinson to Lyndon Johnson. And it seems to suggest that Robinson is trying to assuage the fears of Johnson that all blacks are not like Martin Luther King. Here's what he says.
April 18th, 1967. Dear Mr. President, while I am certain your faith has been shaken by the demonstrations against the Vietnam War, I hope the actions of any one individual doesn't make you feel, as Vice President Humphrey does, that Dr. King's stand will hurt the civil rights movement. There are hundreds of thousands of us at home who are not certain why we are in the war. We feel, however, that you and your staff know what is best, and we are willing to support your effort for an honorable solution to the war. Again, sir, let me thank you for your domestic stand on civil rights. We need an even firmer stand as the issue becomes more personal and the gap between black and white Americans gets wider. Sincerely yours, Jackie Robinson.
That seems to be a clear split, doesn't it, with King over the issue of the war as he relates it to the president, LBJ.
That is a clear split. You're right about that, Tony. And if I may back up just a little bit, I don't want to emphasize the split too much because Robinson and King were really heroes to each other. From 1957 on, they're going back and forth, inviting each other to various activities that each was involved in. King invited Robinson to come to Albany and to come to Birmingham and to chair a campaign to rebuild burned churches, churches that were scorched because of their voting rights efforts. Robinson and King were really heroes to each other. The split between King and Robinson is real, though. We have to remember that Jackie and Rachel Robinson had a son, Jackie Jr., who was serving in Vietnam. They had an obligation to support their son. And at the same time, Jackie did have questions about the Vietnam War engagement, but he was willing to give a pass to LBJ. He just assumed that the president had information that we didn't have. He also believed that Martin Luther King Jr. was putting too much of the blame on the United States and not enough blame on the communists.
In contrast to even the perception of a split between Robinson and King, there is no doubt that there was a very visible and wide split between Malcolm X and Robinson. Jackie Robinson had written very critically about Malcolm X in a newspaper article, and this is Malcolm.
According to the attack you leveled against me and Congressman Powell in your recent column, I must confess that even today you still display the same old speed, the same cunning, and shiftiness, and you are still trying to win the big game for your white boss.
Now, in response to that, Jackie Robinson wrote back to Malcolm X a blistering letter, and this is one passage from it.
You mouth a big and bitter battle, Malcolm, but it's noticeable that your militancy is mainly expressed in Harlem, where it is safe.
Jackie Robinson was an integrationist. Malcolm X was not. Malcolm X favored the use of any means necessary to rectify the injustices against African Americans. Jackie Robinson did not. In this sense, he was just like King. He favored nonviolence and the civil rights movement here in the United States. And he felt as if Malcolm X was misleading the masses into thinking that of that black separate state as a possibility. But you're right. There was no love lost at all between these two.
Now, my producer and I really did enjoy reading these various letters back and forth. But I do have a question because not all the letters were actually written by Jackie Robinson himself, were they?
Right. A lot of them were. And Rachel has images in her head of Jackie Robinson sitting down at the table and at the desk and writing these letters. I talked with her about that briefly. Nevertheless, Robinson did on occasion use ghostwriters. They include Alfred Duckett and Evelyn Cunningham, formerly of the Pittsburgh Courier, and a few others. And they would help him craft letters. And these were professional writers who really helped give form and shape to Robinson's thoughts. And while they did help him craft his letters, those thoughts are uniquely Jackie Robinson's. So let's keep that in mind as well.
Very nice job. Thank you very much for coming on, Michael. We appreciate it.
Tony, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Michael G. Long has edited the Civil Rights Letters of Jackie Robinson. The book is called First Class Citizenship. At 5 a.m. this morning, Pacific Standard Time, bleary-eyed reporters and other media folk gathered in anticipation at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in Beverly Hills. The occasion? The announcement of the 80th annual Oscar nominees. As usual, some surprises popped up, including a nomination for Ruby Dee. It was her first. Here to tell us more is Tanya Hart, who was there in Beverly Hills as the announcements were made. She is a celebrity entertainment reporter for American Urban Radio Networks. Tanya, nice to see you.
Yes, good to be with you always, Tony.
How'd you like that music we played for you?
I loved it. I'm like, where did they get that song from? I want that in my collection.
I bet you do.
I really do. I'm serious. I'm calling the producer when the show's over here.
First things first, before we talk about the nominees, let me ask you, will there even be an Academy Awards show this year?
Well, according to Gil Cates, who's been producing it for several years, he says yes. Come hell or high water, I guess we can say that here, there will be a show. Now, keep in mind, the Academy Awards do have, this is the 80th year. They've got clips for 80 years. I mean, if nothing else, they can put together 80 years worth of clips, and I'm sure it could be very entertaining. However, what we might be missing, of course, is the red carpet. And the red carpet not only is what people want to see, it's really what generates all the money. Last year, I believe, out of 40 million viewers, something like $80 million was generated from that four-hour telecast. That's a lot of money. A lot of people around the world watch the show, and they're counting on it. They love the gowns. They love all of the you know, the stuff that goes on, the limousines and seeing the jewels. That's very much a part of the Academy. So the question is, though, really, Tony, if for some reason the strike is not over, and if, by the way, they are all meeting today, the Board of Governors for the Academy are meeting today with some of the people from the Writers Guild, I understand, and they're trying to come up with a waiver for the Academy, which means that the celebrities would be able to walk the red carpet without crossing a picket line. And that's the big question here. If the strike isn't over, we've got a month, but if it isn't over, can we get that waiver to go on with the show as they would like to see it?
Well, let's talk about the nominations then. There were a couple of surprises this year. Among them, I think it's fair to say, Ruby Dee for Best Supporting Actress. She played Denzel's mom in the movie American Gangster. Remarkably, Tanya, this is her first nomination in a career that spans over a half century.
Do you believe it?
I can't believe it.
She started her film career with a movie called What a Guy in 1939, Tony.
Right.
1939 is when she did her very first film. And this nomination for Ruby, by the way, makes her the second oldest nominee ever for Best Supporting Actress. That's, of course, right behind Gloria Stewart. She was 87 when she was nominated and won for her role in Titanic. I was there that night. That was a special moment. And, of course, Ruby Dee, I think is, I'm not going, you know, we don't talk about how old women are, but
no,
she's somewhere up there in her early 80s, which is very young these days.
That's true, and I'm really sad that Ossie Davis, her late husband, is not here to see this.
Isn't this something? You know what I find ironic, too, about the 1939, I just realized she started her film career the same year that the first African-American won an Oscar, period. Of course, that was Hattie McDaniel in 1939 for Gone with the Wind. And she was nominated and won as Best Supporting Actress. I think that's a sign.
Maybe so. In fact, speaking of signs, let me ask you this. Because last year there was a lot of buzz about the black Oscars being obsolete. And the reason for that was people like Jennifer Hudson, Forest Whitaker's wins, supposedly testaments to how mainstream Hollywood had finally given black artists in film the respect that they deserved. So, given the shortage of African American nominations this year, are those attitudes the same, or, you know, what's going on?
Well, I guess people will retract that attitude, huh?
You
know, like
so.
I always say, don't ever get too comfortable in this game, honey, because you never know what's going to happen here. You know, which is really kind of sad, too, because there were some stellar performances by African Americans this year. I was really surprised. You know, everybody's been talking Denzel and, of course, The Great Debaters. A couple of things. I was very surprised that in a year when violent films pretty much seem to rule, I mean, you've got There Will Be Blood, you've got No Country for Old Men, which I've got to tell you is the most violent thing I think I've ever seen. I was surprised that American Gangster did not get a nomination as Best Picture, because it really is a good movie, no matter what you think of the subject matter. People were talking about Denzel possibly getting a director nomination, which I thought might be a long shot. Obviously, it was. But you know what I was surprised about?
What?
I was really surprised that nobody picked up on Don Cheadle's performance in Talk to Me.
Mm-hmm.
That is truly one of the best performances I had seen on film this year, barring any. And, you know, it goes back to the studios really getting out there and stomping. I mean, this is like a political game. This is like, you know, any other campaign. If the studios don't campaign for it, nobody notices.
You know what? I was thinking about Eddie Murphy. Last year, this time, Eddie Murphy was nominated for Best Supporting Actress in Dreamgirls. This year, not only is he not out there, he has the most nominations for the Razzies, which is the worst performance and the worst movies competition. Did you know
that? That must be Norbit.
That's for Norbit, exactly.
Well, you know what's really funny? Norbit actually got an Academy nomination, and I don't want to step away from the mic. I'll try to pull it over here. But there was something in the Academy nomination. It's one of the technical fields, technical things.
It wasn't makeup, was it?
Could have probably. You know what? Hold on 1 second, and I'll try to grab my notes here. The Oscars have gone green this year, so they usually give us a bunch of notes, but this year they put them on both sides because they're trying to conserve.
Save
isn't
papers.
That wonderful? And I'm not seeing it right now, but I know that Norbit did get a nomination for something, probably makeup or one of those categories. But yeah, that's true. I personally think Eddie Murphy got robbed last year.
He
lost to Alan Alden. We love Alan Alden, but you know the Little Miss Sunshine and his there was no comparison.
Alan Arkin, yeah, that's right.
Alan Arkin.
Well, this
Arkin. I said Alan Alden.
I know you
had
to get up early today to be there. I used to do that, and it's tough. So we're going to let you go and let you get some rest. Tanya Hart, thank you so much for coming and sharing that information.
Thank you.
With
Don't
us
forget,
today.
I want that song.
I'll work on it for you. Tanya Hart, celebrity entertainment reporter for American Urban Radio Networks, speaking to us from her home in the Hollywood Hills.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music.
Upon a broken guitar.